access their college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, current students may register for classes, drop and add classes, pay for classes, retrieve grades, view and print schedules, get updates on financial aid info, check account balances. Log on to WebAdvisor at my.hfcc.edu or from the HFCC homepage at www.hfcc.edu.
Hello, my name is Phil Mack, and I'm here to tell you about a new and different kind of show coming to WHFR called Thematic. It's on every Thursday morning from 10 until noon. Since music is a universal language, let's see if that holds true by looking at different musical styles on selected themes. Each week, there will be songs from different genres that express their viewpoint on that theme. There will also be a weekly artist showcase, and of course, plenty of variety. It's a new way of looking at music. So on every Thursday morning from 10 until noon, it's Thematic. Thematic, thematic. Organizing music for you, one song at a time. On WHFR, the only station making waves.
If you want to know what's going on around town, tune in to the Motor Calendar on WHFR 4 to 5 every Thursday. We encourage you to get out and support live music. You'll learn where local bands are playing and what they sound like. That's the Motor Calendar, every Thursday, 4 to 5, on the station making waves.
When I grow up, I want to be a fireman, because it's like the coolest job ever. They get to save lives, and who doesn't want to do that?
If your child is sick over and over again, it could be PI, a defect in the immune system that affects millions. Early detection can give children a chance to dream.
Jeffrey Modell Foundation, 25 years of helping children reach for their dreams. Visit us at info4pi.org or call 1-866-INFO-4-PI.
Teach me another one.
Okay. A chick in a car and a car won't go. That's the way to spell Chicago.
C-H-I-C-A-G-O.
That's right.
Dad, how about Mississippi?
You ready for Mississippi? Okay, let's go.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Variety's pretty hard to find on today's airwaves. How about joining the cause to promote alternative variety? TCM 189 is the staff training course for HFCC's own WHFR, a station devoted to new, local, and unique artists. The course provides students with essential station procedures as well as equipment knowledge and basic performance skills. The class can be taken for credit or under the Center for Lifelong Learning. For more information, contact Susan McGraw, WHFR's general manager at 313-845-9842.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, And you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves. And for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And this is a special show in many ways. This show marks the 6th anniversary of We Are Not Alone on WHFR. And we're starting our 7th year here on the air. I'd like to thank WHFR for providing me with a platform which I can provide top-quality guests in the UFO field. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for sticking around with us, our loyal listeners, for the past 6 years. Without them, I'd just be sitting here talking to myself. So thank you very much for listening. So let's get the 7th year started. And speaking of top-quality guests, our guest today is Dr. Jesse Marcel, Jr. Dr. Marcel joined the U.S. Navy in 1962 and shortly thereafter participated in the Cuban Missile Crisis. He retired from the Navy in July of 1971 and entered private practice as a surgeon in Helena, Montana. He joined the Montana Army National Guard in 1973, went through helicopter flight training as a flight surgeon at Fort Rucker, Alabama, earning his wings in 1981. Jesse retired from the military the second time in August of 1996 on his 60th birthday. But because of the Iraqi war, he was called back to active duty in October of 2004 at the age of 68, where he served as a flight surgeon for the 189th Attack Helicopter Battalion. He was discharged again from the active duty as a full bird colonel in December of 2005. But apart from his being an American military hero, Jesse Marcel Jr. is best known as one of the first people to view and handle the debris from the crash of an unknown object in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. He is the author of the book, The Roswell Legacy. So here to tell us about his experiences and his book is Jesse Marcel, Jr. And welcome to the show, Jesse.
Well, thanks, Dave. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, you served in the Iraqi War at the age of what? 60?
Well, I served my 69th birthday in a Black Hawk helicopter flying over Baghdad. So
happy birthday to you.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, man. That was something. I know, here in ufological circles, we talked about you a lot while you were over there. And the fact that at your age you were serving your country in the military in Iraq, that's something else. God bless you, and thank you so much for doing so.
Well, life is a real adventure.
I guess, and it never stops, does it? Well, sooner or later, I guess it does, but
yeah.
While you can keep it going, right?
You betcha.
There you go. So here's the scene, 1947. You're a boy fast asleep in your bed in the wee small hours of the morning. And what happens next?
Well, you know, my dad, knocked on my door, got myself up. My mother's already up. He said something about he had some things that we were to see in the kitchen. So what he had done is to spread some debris of an unknown object on the kitchen floor. And he said something like, I think this is parts of a flying saucer. And again, at that time, I was not quite sure what a flying saucer was, but he was very excited about it. So that tweaked my interest in it. And he says, you know, look at this, because you'll probably never see anything like this again, which is true. I never have. But it was very different there.
Okay, describe this stuff.
Well, there was a lot of metal foil and some beam members. They looked like little I-beams with a writing or some kind of symbology along the inside surface of it. Thinking at first it was like Egyptian hieroglyphics, but it really was not that. It's more like mathematical geometric symbols written in various shapes and forms. The color itself was very distinctive. It was a kind of purple-violet hue, semi-reflective of light. And just imprinted on the inside surface of this little beam that was about 12 to 18 inches long, about 3/8 of an inch in cross-sectional diameter. And again, I said, well, that's different.
Mm-hmm. But you say you're 12 at the time?
11.
You were 11 at the time.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So you didn't quite know what to make of this. And your father said something about it being a debris from a flying saucer or a flying disc?
Yeah, well, again, he was very excited, which, of course, made me excited, too. Uh-huh. And, you know, the first thing he said, well, look at this, but see if you can find any kind of electronic components in there, like vacuum tubes, resistors, wires, connectors. But there wasn't anything like that. But he already knew that because he wanted me to satisfy my own curiosity on this.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, there was no electronic components there, but just this metallic debris. There was also some black plastic material like a broken phonograph record. But, mm-hmm. But I, you know, again, just strange.
Strange stuff. And
yeah.
You never
the foil was like a mylar of today. Except it was very light, very thin. You know, I didn't try to bend it or tear it or anything like that, but my dad later said that you could bend it or, and it would come back in its original shape.
You could.
In fact, I heard him say that one of the men in his office took a sledgehammer to a larger piece than I saw and could not make a permanent deformity in this thing. So, you know, we didn't have anything like that in 1947.
No. Do we have anything like that now?
Well, not that I know of.
I was going to say, maybe they back-engineered it and we have it now, but from what you're saying, and I guess as a full-bird colonel in the military, you would know if we had something similar to that, wouldn't you?
Well, I've been in a lot of different aircraft, you know. I flew helicopters. I've been in a lot of different military aircraft types, you know, C-130s,
mm-hmm.
C-17s, C-7s. So I've flown just about every kind of military aircraft that we have,
mm-hmm.
but nothing like that.
Okay. So was there any talk around the base or in your school about the event?
Actually not, because, you know, as this documentary unfolded, my dad, we looked at this for about 15 or 20 minutes in our kitchen floor, and I helped my dad box it back up and move it back to our 1942 Buick. They had just driven in, and then I went to bed, and I didn't see him for a day or two after that. I guess at that time he was in Fort Worth showing the debris to General Ramey, who was the 8th Air Force commander. And as a matter of fact, I did see photographs of my dad holding some debris that was positioned on General Ramey's floor,
mm-hmm.
and it was taken by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, you know, Bon Johnson, photographer. And I thought, you know, this is not what we saw on our kitchen floor in Roswell. So they had switched it. And you look at the look of my dad's face, and it's like, you got to be kidding me. This is not what I brought home, nor is this what I brought to Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
They changed it, and that's where the story started to be changed for a weather balloon or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But it's totally different from what we saw.
Okay. Did he ever mention, I know you were 11 at the time, you know, I'm sure he wouldn't have confided in you at that time, but did he mention then that that wasn't the stuff that I picked up or brought home? Did he mention that to
you? Yeah, I heard him. You know, we didn't discuss it, because when he got back from Fort Worth, he sat my mother and myself down and said that we were under no circumstances to ever talk about this again.
Hmm.
However, later in an interview, I heard him say something to the fact that it was switched. And I guess one of Ramey's aides also said it was switched, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your dad, Jesse Marcel Sr., you say took it to Texas.
Right.
For the purpose of what?
Well, you know, Colonel Blanchard wanted to... 8th Air Force commander to see this, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he ordered my dad to fly portions of this wreckage to General Ramey in Fort Worth at the Fort Worth Army Airfield. They flew it in a B-29 under armed guard, and he demonstrated the material to General Ramey. But then in the photographs of the area, they switched the debris to something totally different.
So... first it came out on the news and in the newspaper and on the radio that they found one of these flying discs, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, no, sorry, these guys can't tell the difference between a weather balloon and a flying disc.
Yeah, mistaken identity.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let's say it was, and then, of course, later it was not a weather balloon, but a mogul balloon, which was, what are mogul balloons for then?
Well, a mogul balloon was a top-secret device that was designed to listen, you know, or bring microphones up into the stratosphere to listen for possible atomic explosions from the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mission was top-secret, but the material itself was just off-the-shelf. Still, a balloon is a balloon, and
right.
The microphones and electronic debris and all that, but that's not what he brought home.
So even if it were a balloon, if it was a balloon or a mogul balloon, what's the why would they want to fly the debris to Texas to have it analyzed?
Well, that's a good question. Because the debris they flew to Texas was not the mogul balloon nor a weather balloon.
Right.
So they're totally different.
Right. So were you on the base in the days that followed the event?
No, we lived in town at that time, 1300 West 7th Street.
Okay, so you went to a public school there? Or?
I did, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, St. Peter's, the Roman Catholic school, after the public school.
Okay. So you weren't able to personally see if there were any hangars that had debris or cordoned off? Or?
No. Yeah. I was off the base at that time.
Okay, so later in life, did your dad ever sit down and talk with you as an adult and talk about this event?
Well, you know, again, we were told not to talk about that, and we really didn't. I guess Stan Friedman is the one who first started interviewing my dad about the information that we had seen there in Roswell. So that was 1978, so he started talking about it in 1978, and I never really talked about it, but I did. Yeah, asking questions occasionally, you know, when I call him. Like I knew that he had gone out to the debris field years later at the behest of WDSU, I believe it was.
Mm.
And I asked him jokingly, was there any debris still out there? And he said, no, they had vacuumed that place up years before. So those were his words. They vacuumed the place up. So we're not going to leave any real debris out there.
Well, now how much debris would a weather balloon or even a mogul balloon? I know a mogul balloon is, I assume, much longer tail than a weather balloon, correct?
Yeah.
So how much would they have to clean up? You know what I'm saying?
Well, not a whole lot. It would not cover a large area.
Right.
And my dad described that the debris field encompassed maybe a mile, maybe a half mile, around with all the debris, and they still didn't get it all. Yeah, I think what they did, they later sent a crew out there to pick up the rest of it, and I think they flew it somewhere in a C-54.
Flew it where?
I think right to Anderson, if I heard the rumors right.
Mm-hmm.
But I was out of the loop to know this, but
right.
C-54 is a big cargo plane,
mm-hmm.
and put a lot of stuff in the C-54.
More than would be required for a mogul balloon.
Yeah, a small dumpster would control contain all the debris from a weather balloon.
But they needed a huge cargo plane.
Yes.
Nice. I assume because of your book and everything, you must have talked to some of the witnesses or some of the people in Roswell who claim to have been on the scene or what have you?
Yeah, I've done a lot of reading, and a lot of people I knew in Roswell were associated with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Walter Hout, who's the public information officer, lived right down the block from us. But again, we really didn't discuss it. But I did talk to people who were out there, and I did a lot of reading on this thing, and I compared with my knowledge of what this looked like.
Okay. So the people that you talked to, the witnesses that you talked to, Were they witness to bodies or debris? Did any of them have any of that debris?
You know, my dad did not see the bodies or anything like that, but he knew people who did, and that's one thing we discussed. As a matter of fact, my wife asked my dad, did he actually personally see the bodies, but he said no, he didn't. But he knew people who did see them.
Mm-hmm. What did they? What did you say they looked like, these bodies?
You know, I never talked to anybody who really saw the bodies.
Mm-hmm. So the some people that saw this debris, you talked to people that saw the debris, correct?
Actually, no, I did not talk to anybody who saw the debris. Because, you know, once it left our house, this whole subject was dropped. And not until years later did I read about other people seeing the debris and describing pretty much what I saw. But at that time, you know, the story was killed the day later. What happened when my dad came back from Fort Worth, Colonel Blanchard put out an order for the story to be dumped in the paper. You know, the first headline was that the Air Force recovered a flying saucer. Then the next day they killed the story. Because what happened, the story was killed in Roswell. In other words, my friends never heard about that, and I never talked to them about that because it was a taboo subject there.
Right.
So.
Right. So okay, so the first day, the guy comes out on the radio and says that we found one of these flying discs that people have seen and out near Roswell, New Mexico. Now, rumor has it, maybe you've heard it or you could confirm it, that after that story aired on the radio, the station was approached and said by the government or somebody that said, don't ever air that story again or we'll pull the plug and your station will be off the air for good.
Yeah, I've heard other people talk about that, yes.
Do you know that as a fact?
Well, you know, I didn't hear the broadcast, you know, but I've heard other people talk about that. I guess the radio station manager at KGFL talked about the fact that his license would be pulled if he kept talking about that.
All right, okay. So by the next day, they had it as a weather balloon, correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
And now I'm going to have to take a short break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Here in Dearborn, Michigan, out of Henry Ford Community College. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Jesse Marcel Jr., a full bird colonel, retired, of course, and author of The Roswell Legacy. So one of the first people to handle the debris from Roswell crash. And I thought it might be interesting to listen to the original radio report from 1947 of the right after the crash at Roswell. This came out right after the crash in July of 1947, and then right afterwards it was debunked, saying it was a weather balloon. So not very good quality, but this was on the radio in 1947. So listen to this.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection. Late this afternoon, a bulletin from New Mexico suggested that the widely publicized mystery of the flying saucers may soon be solved. Army Air Force officers reported that one of the strange discs had been found and inspected sometime last week. Our correspondents in Los Angeles and Chicago have been in contact with Army officials endeavoring to obtain all possible late information. Joe Wilson reports to us now from Chicago. The Army may be getting to the bottom of all this talk about the so-called flying saucers. As a matter of fact, the 509th Atomic Bomb Group headquarters at Roswell, New Mexico, reports that it has received one of the discs which landed on a ranch outside Roswell. The disc landed at a ranch at Corona, New Mexico. and the rancher turned it over to the Air Force. Rancher W.W. Grizzell was the man who discovered the saucer. Colonel William Blanchard of the Roswell Air Base refuses to give details of what the flying disc looks like. In Fort Worth, Texas, where the object was first sent, Brigadier General Roger Remy says that it is being shipped by air to the AAF Research Center at Wright Field, Ohio. A few moments ago, I talked to officials at Wright Field, and they declared that they expect the so-called flying saucer to be delivered there, but that it hasn't arrived as yet. In the meantime, General Remy describes the object as being of flimsy construction, almost like a box type. He says that it was so battered that he was unable to determine whether it had a disc form, and he does not indicate its size. Remy says that so far as can be determined, no one saw the object in the air, and he describes it as being made of some sort of tinfoil. Other Army officials say that further information indicates that the object had a diameter of about 20 to 25 feet, and that nothing in the apparent construction indicated any capacity for speed, and that there was no evidence of a power plant. The disc also appeared too flimsy to carry a man. Now, back to Taylor Grant in New York.
So that was the original report about a disc crashing in the Roswell, New Mexico area in the desert in 1947. So let's get back to Dr. Jesse Marcel. Where were we now? We were talking of, the bodies, allegedly, when Stanton Friedman was checking out the story of these bodies, they were supposed to be 3.5 to 4 feet in height, wearing a tight silvery jumpsuit-like outfits, and skulls larger than normal with big black eyes. And then the government comes out and says what those were crash test dummies. Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's a big joke, because the crash test are anthropomorphic. You know, they're 6 feet tall and weigh 150 pounds or something like that. But obviously, the people who saw the bodies from the crash site were described something totally different from these crash test dummies.
Right. So they couldn't possibly have been crash test. Plus,
and the crash test dummies were years later too.
Right. I was going to say, because Stanton Friedman says it didn't happen until, they didn't start doing that until, 54 or something like that, 52,
yeah,
54.
So, yeah, right, years later.
So he calls them time-traveling crash test dummies.
Must be,
something else. But then they say, case closed. That was a Mogul balloon, and those are crash test dummies, and they took, I don't know how many hundreds of pages to say this. And they say case closed, and they've never answered any of these objections from Stanton Friedman or anyone else. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I got a call from the Air Force to be answer questions they had. They say, we want to know what you saw, so I described exactly what I saw to them. And and they interviewed me for about a half an hour on the phone, but none of my interview got into the case closed document.
Oh, really?
It was totally ignored. Which, of course, it would be.
Well, why did they bother asking you questions?
Yeah, I don't know. It was on their dime, though, so whatever.
It was on their dime, okay. So, I mean, justify their pay, is that it?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Good enough reason.
Now, there were supposed to have been actually two other UFO crashes in the Corona, New Mexico area about the same time. What do you know about those?
Well, the only thing I know is when I read the papers. I think there was a primary debris field that my dad was involved with.
Right.
And that was the material that I saw that he picked up from the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently there was another crash some distance away there, which I think might have been the main body of the craft. Because the material I saw looked like it came from the inside, like it was interior. And my theory is, and this is just my theory, that whatever happened to this thing, they had an in-flight explosion, blew portions of the debris out from the side of the craft, crippling it, and the main body of the craft crashed some distance away. And the bodies, if they were there, that's where they were located, where the main body was located.
Hmm.
But that's just my theory.
Right. So can you share any details, if any, that your father had confided in you about the crash?
He was not involved with the secondary crash site, you know, where the main body of the crash was located.
Right.
You know, what they did, they compartmentalized this. They sent one group of people to the first site, another group of people to the second site, and they never managed to get together to compare notes.
Hmm. I'll bet somebody.
That's why they keep things a secret, yeah.
I'll bet somebody compared notes of the two crashes.
Oh, yeah, there's one. Somebody knew the whole story, but only very few people knew the whole story, I'm sure.
Yeah. And there was supposed to be, on the second crash site, there was supposed to be living alien beings.
Yeah, that's what I read. Yeah. I was not in the loop to know about that, but just what I read later.
Right, right. So tell us about your book, The Roswell Legacy. Does it go more into detail?
Well, you know what I did? I tried to establish my dad's credibility with that book, because after he died, there was a lot of, people going around, if you don't like the message, kill the messenger. And there was a lot of ugly stuff written about him that was totally lies, and I wanted to establish his credibility. Like, he knew what a weather balloon looked like because he went to radar school. You know, he studied the raw one target, so if it was a raw one target, he would not have brought it home. He brought it to the nearest dumpster. But and he was Air Force intelligence. He was a member of the 509th Bomb Group, which was a select group, handpicked people, because they dropped their atomic bomb on Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Air Force intelligence. As a matter of fact, he was in the faculty of Air Force intelligence school. So he knew what he's talking about.
Right.
And I just want to put a lie to the people who were talking about him who were not good enough to lick the mud off his boots.
Very good. Well, I believe that, because they were all top-notch officers in 509th.
Oh, yeah.
They would have to be. They would have to be. And it was not just Jesse Marcel Sr. that was saying this. It was publicist, I'm not going to remember his name, the guy that released the story. Hot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a public information officer. Walter Hout.
Walter Hout, yes.
Yeah, H-A-U-T.
And then Ramey as well. Wasn't it Ramey that said go ahead? No, it was Ramey who changed the story, correct?
Yeah, that's right. They changed the story right there in Ramey's office. And so this is not to be released publicly because whatever reason. But so I guess Ramey must have ordered Colonel Blanchard, the base commander at Roswell, to put out the story that, we made a mistake of identification. This is not a flying saucer, but it was just a plain old weather balloon. How could we have made that big a mistake?
How could all of us here have made that mistake, right?
Yeah, you betcha.
All of these officers that in charge of the only atomic facility in the United States of America cannot distinguish a weather balloon from an alien craft.
Yeah. Well, you know, Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander, was out there on Tinian Island, and he's the one who selected Colonel Tibbetts to be the pilot of the Enola Gay and dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, the uranium bomb.
Right.
So they were all mixed up with the nuclear bombing.
Right, right.
They had practice bombing in Wendover, in Nevada, and, well, it's a very complicated story.
We have time. But you can't tell me? Is that it?
Well, no, my dad was with the 509th, and as the intelligence officer, he was he helped, study the bomb flight, or the practice bombs here in Wendover.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did, they practiced bombing using devices that were the same size as the atomic bomb. So they could maybe practice on the targets out there.
Hmm.
But Colonel Blanchard was one who actually chose Colonel Tibbetts to drop the bomb from the Enola Gay.
Hmm.
And so...
Yeah, now I don't know. Go ahead.
Hey, I don't know if Colonel Tibbetts is still alive, but he might have died recently, but he was the main pilot on the Enola Gay. And then there was the... the B-29, the boxcar that dropped the plutonium bomb on Nagasaki. I know. Mm-hmm. It's just a memory that you don't like to hear, you don't like to remember.
Yeah, I know. But there it is, you know.
Yeah, it is what it is.
And, you know, I was going to say that from what I understood, of course, I was born in 48, but...
Oh, you're just a pup.
I'm just a pup, yeah. That's why I got to call you guys and ask you, fill in the blanks here, you know, because I don't know. I'm just a kid.
Yeah.
I like to think, anyway.
And, for sure.
Well, at any rate, I was told, in fact, I remember my mother telling me, they didn't know when they tested the atomic bomb. They said, well, if one atom splits the next, and then those atoms split the next, and on and on and on, what's to stop them from just keep going and splitting atoms all around the world?
And, well, you know, there's some thought of that, you know, when they were going to, yeah, they didn't have to test the uranium bomb because they knew that was going to work. It was the plutonium bomb, you know, that was the implosion device. They were not quite sure that that was going to work, so that's the reason they tested it in New Mexico in July 1945.
All right.
And I guess Enrico Fermi was out there, and he was kind of wondering that, you know, there's nitrogen in the air, and it's possible it could ignite the nitrogen in the air. So they took bets as to whether they're going to fly this test or not.
Yeah. So bottom line, they thought, oh, well, let's give it a shot and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So they're pretty sure it was not going to ignite the nitrogen in the air, but they weren't absolutely sure.
No. That's scary, isn't it? That's scary. Of course,
really?
And when they saw the mushroom cloud going out and out and out, they thought, oh, I guess maybe it is going to do that.
Did we drop a decimal point there?
Yeah. But fortunately, it didn't. But
yeah,
that's
it.
Scary.
Only took about 10 kilograms of plutonium to bring about a 20 kiloton blast.
Hmm, it's scary. Now that's another thing. We've talked about this on the show before. It was shortly after the bomb started being tested and being dropped. Atomic weapons started being used. That 1947 comes about, and these UFOs start being people start seeing these UFOs around, and they seem to today hover around our nuclear facilities, nuclear powered battleships, what have you. They seem to be interested in our nuclear devices.
Yeah, that is kind of a curious thing, isn't it? You know, obviously, New Mexico would have been brought to their attention with the atomic bomb test.
Right.
And they just want to know what stage we're at with our nuclear development there, because we can now, you know, eliminate ourselves if worse comes to worse.
So, and I've said this before, other people have said this before, I think it was Dan Friedman said that they're looking at us and say the kids have found the matches.
Yeah, really. It's a good way to say it.
Yeah. So do you think?
But you know, they went through their nuclear phase too, so they survived there. So, pray to God that we survive ours.
Well, if you figure there has to be so many other civilizations out there throughout the universe, you know,
yeah.
Our knowledge of the universe is growing so rapidly that. So many civilizations, how many of them did not make it through that stage?
Well, that's right. You know, they think there's billions of Earth-like planets. In other words, planets that support life just like us. You know, they're in the habitable zone of their parent star. They're in the, zone where water can be liquid, and because that's what it takes for life. And they think there are billions of Earth-like planets out there. Some may be larger than our planet, some smaller than our planet, but they're capable of supporting life.
Right.
You know, the Kepler telescope is finding out hundreds of planets every day, just about.
Right. And they always said that first science says if a planet had water on it, it's got to have life, because all it needs is planet needs is water, and there's going to be life, right? And yeah. That's why...
Yeah, they say water is the one prime ingredient that, so far as we know, life requires for sure.
Right.
There may be other elements, but we do know that wherever you find water, you find life.
Right, right. And that's why they assumed, you know how you spell that word, that other planets out there could not have water. Mars could not have water on it. There could not be water on the moon or in the moon or what have you. And then they find out.
Yeah, we're not sure about Mars not having water on it because they found ice on the in the polar caps there.
Mm-hmm.
And they've seen where there might be some drainage channels of liquid water on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these are fairly recent.
But
so we think there might be a subterranean water on Mars.
Right, that's what I'm
if
saying.
If there is, there's life on Mars.
And when the rover landed, you had the camera going, pointing down at the feet of the rover in, I guess, Houston, whatever, wherever they were controlling it, looked at that, and one guy said, it looks like mud, but it can't be mud. It can't be mud because there's no water. You know, we all know there can't be water on Mars, so it can't be mud. Well, surprise.
Well, yeah, don't say that. I think there is.
Well, certainly.
From what I've been reading.
Certainly. And they find some kind of moss, I believe it. I wish I knew the name of it. I sound ignorant now, but they found some kind of moss on it, on the planet.
You know, the bottom line here, there are intelligent civilizations by the billions in our one galaxy. And there's 100 trillion galaxies in the universe that we can see.
Right.
So, you know, there's intelligent life all over the place. And I think some of it is interesting. So far, they do not seem to be malevolent or destructive force, but maybe we've been lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that there's possibly, you know, I always say that there's malevolent and benevolent and indifferent people all over the world, and why should it be any different throughout the universe?
Yeah, right.
Do you think there
might be some Nazi civilizations out there are in the wings of, you know, so we don't know.
We don't know.
But I think so far the ones that have found us or have been looking at us or studying us have been, you know, just like scientists here, want to see just out of curiosity
right.
what stage of development we are. Are we going to survive our nuclear phase or not? Or, you know, so far I think we've been lucky. I know Stephen Hawking has said that, you know, we probably shouldn't advertise our presence, but I think it's too late. They already know we're here.
Oh, they already know we're here. Well, certainly. He said Hawking said it didn't work out well for Columbus.
Yeah, right.
it didn't work out well for the
Indians,
the Native Americans.
Yeah.
Well, you know, why should we judge extraterrestrials that we know nothing about by our own personalities? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my hope is that the vast majority of them are just studying us for research purposes. You know, we'd be very curious about life on other planets too. And I think, you know, they're scientists. You know, they're sending out probes to investigate other life-bearing planets like Earth. And but you know, they're out there.
All right. I need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here in Dearborn, Michigan, out of Henry Ford Community College. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Jesse Marcel, Jr., and his father was, of course, Jesse Marcel, Sr., and the one that... dragged in some of the debris from the Roswell crash in 1947. And young Jesse Jr. took a look at it on his kitchen floor and said, what the heck is this stuff? Am I right? Is it?
You betcha. You know, well, since 1947, I've known that we're not alone.
Right.
And
right.
that's maybe intentionally interesting astronomy and cosmology.
Right. Have you voiced your this opinion or your story while in on active duty?
I've had a lot of, I've had several flag rank generals, corner me and talk to me about this.
Really?
And, there's an intense interest there. Well, I think the Army or the military basically is removed from the situation. They gather sightings and things like that and probably forward them on to other people to make studies of it. But but there is an intense interest in that.
Okay, but all they're gathering really is anecdotal material, am I correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But
I don't think they have control over any debris or any concrete material like that.
But somebody does, don't you agree?
Somebody's got it.
somebody's got it. We don't have the evidence. You guys don't have the evidence, you see. But, of course, we don't have the evidence. You guys, somebody has taken it and put it underground.
It's being studied someplace. I hear a lot about Area 51, but I'm not sure about that. But, I heard rumors said that it was brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Maybe it's Sandy Labs in New Mexico, but there's probably various places where they are actually studying the debris. And don't forget Russia. They have debris also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does in Germany as well.
In Germany, yeah. It's not just a phenomenon for the United States, but this is a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, certainly. And so many countries are now coming forward and releasing some of their data, some of their information on the UFO phenomenon. And the Cometa report from France said, these are probably extraterrestrial craft. And the United States knows about it, and they're not being forthcoming with it like we are.
The Belgium Air Force has concrete photographs of triangular platforms.
Right.
That they come out and say, this does not belong to us. And they're not experimental aircraft that we know about, but they are pretty sure they're extraterrestrial.
Right.
But they're more honest and forthcoming than we are.
Definitely. Why do you think that is? We're supposed to be, this is America, the greatest democracy in the world. Why aren't we more forthcoming?
Well, I think, like Stan Friedman says, that, we should not be regarded as Americans or French or Russians, but we should be considered as Earthlings.
That's right. But I'm saying, here in America, we tout ourselves as being a democracy, the greatest democracy in the world, freedom of information and all of this good stuff. And yet everything is secret, everything.
I don't know why they want to keep it that way, but I know for one that we are being visited, and it is what it is.
It is what it is. I'm afraid so. We were talking before about whether or not they're malevolent, benevolent. Don't you think there are some malevolent groups out there? And is it possible? Do you think that we're being protected by benevolent beings because we don't have the ability to protect ourselves?
Yeah, it could be. Who knows? We may have some friends out there that we don't know about.
Yeah. Friends in high places? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, friends in high places. That's good.
I like that one.
That's a good way to say it.
That's a good way to say it. I think so. I think that's it completely because, a lot of these alleged abductees, and I say alleged because, I can't prove it. there is a lot of evidence to show, these. We had Dr. You know who Dr. Lear is, Roger Lear?
Yeah, I know Roger, yes.
Yeah, and these implants that they find, they are very anomalous little pieces of metal that are found in people and are giving off subspace radio signals while attached to the nervous system. And so there's a lot of physical evidence to prove.
Yeah. If you ever talked to Bud Hopkins?
I did.
He wrote some excellent articles on this thing, and he's a guy that I believe he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess he died, so I guess he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I had the pleasure of having him on the show a few years back, I think 4 years back, and unfortunately passed away, but he's got a lot, he had a lot of information on it, and that information lives on in his studies and his paperwork. And
it's still here, yes.
It's in his
research
books.
Is still valid.
Yes, yes. Of course, now he's not around to defend himself, so the the debunkers come crawling out of the woodwork and attacking his work, and you know.
Well, I know. You know, when I die, it'll be the same thing with me. So
certainly,
what the heck? I don't really care.
Yeah, all you can do is put it out there, and you know, it's going to live on. It's going to live on, and there's going to be when our generation is gone, there's going to be a brand new generation of witnesses. And investigators who are going to pick up the gauntlet and keep on running with it.
Yes. As time goes on, it'll be harder and harder to keep this a secret.
Yeah. That's another thing.
What's happening will be more obvious as to what's actually going on.
We've talked on the show before about, with different guests, about it being kept secret. And my theory is, and it's not an original theory, is that it's really not a secret. They're just kind of letting us come out with what we know, and pretty soon the facts will be self-evident.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, they're not going to come out and say, yes, we are not alone. Yes, we have been visited. Yes, we have the evidence. They're just going to let us find this out for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, people ask, why haven't they not contacted us directly, like landing on the White House lawn or wherever? But my feeling is they probably have more to fear from us than we from them.
Oh, yeah.
Because knowing what I know about war, pretend to shoot first, ask questions later.
Well, it wasn't always that way. Way back when, 2,000, 4,000 years ago, religious annals, canon, and history with the Romans and their flying shields. They called them flying shields. That type
of thing.
So, they would land. They really didn't have much to fear from us back then. We'd throw stones at them. Mostly revere them as gods.
Yeah.
Right? And
that's my feeling,
So they had nothing to fear from us. But now they do.
Now they do. Our spears are bigger now.
Yeah,
our stones are bigger.
we got much bigger stones. So, yeah. and I think they are also afraid that, like I said, the kids have found the matches, and our next step is to go out into space and take our petty wars out into space as well.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
Yeah. Do you think if it comes to that, they will make themselves known on completely?
They might just say that, well, we're not going to have anything to do with those guys. They're still growing up. They're still infantile. And let's let them mature for a while before we try to make any definite contact with them.
Yeah, but if we start threatening them or other planets or outer space...
Yeah, if we get in a position to threaten them, well, then that's another matter.
Right. But I think we're threatening them without us really knowing it, by our atomic abilities or their knowledge of atomic abilities and going out into space.
Yeah, we're starting to venture out in space ourselves. We got the Pioneer space probes that are now into interstellar space. They're out of the our own backyard now. So once we start doing that, then that might give a little food for thought to really be careful, more careful with us. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have the mind of an alien, so I'm not sure what they think.
You don't. Maybe someone's listening to us right now saying maybe they're both aliens. You don't know. You don't know. But we are going out into space. We're landing on... Of course, unmanned, landing on Mars. It's just, you know, it's a very small step. We think it's a big step, but it's a very small step in the scheme of things.
Well, sure it is. Well,
and we're going to keep going. And
well, we're very young, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they know it, too. I mean, when I say they, if we're being visited, they know it. And they don't want us to take our atomic weapons out into space and threaten them. Don't you think?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of food for thought there. You know, we're still in our adolescent phase. Obviously they're going to keep a close tab on us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are. And they keep abducting people. You know, you think, don't they know what we're made of by now?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, don't we as, doesn't our science go out and still take samples of animals in the jungle?
And, yeah, well, yeah, it's I'm sure that they're curious as to what makes us tick, you know.
Yeah. One theory is that they're developing a hybrid race. That's where they're interested in sperm, ovum, and taking samples, impregnating women, crossbreeding.
Yeah, I have to be a real strong skeptic about that, but who knows, you know.
Yeah. Well, this is the thought. What do you think about the abduction phenomenon itself?
Well, you know, Bud Hopkins was a very thorough investigator, so you have to believe that he knew what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I know Bud, and I believe in what he says. So I suspect that some of it is actually taking place. I don't think it's as much as people say it is, but
mm-hmm.
who am I to say? Because I'm not in the loop to know.
Right. Like the Betty and Barney Hill case?
Yeah.
That's pretty strong evidence right there.
Yeah, Friedman wrote a good book about that.
Yes. And Kathleen Martin. I'm going to try to get Kathleen Martin on the mm-hmm. on this show. So, Kathleen, if you're listening, I would like to have you on my show. Yeah. This is the way I get new guests. I'm talking to one guest, and I invite somebody else, you see. It's one way to do it.
It's a plan. It's a good plan.
So where do you think this is all going, these Roswell? It's been talked about and talked about for so many years, especially since, it was pretty much dropped in 47. But since Stanton Friedman revived it, brought it back to life, it has been talked about since then, in the 70s.
Yeah.
Where all do you think this is going?
Well, I think it's just an ongoing procedure. I think Roswell is certainly not the only one. There's others coming up, maybe some visitations that will happen but haven't happened yet. But but I think, you know, Roswell itself probably has been investigated as much as people can investigate without any new material to say.
Right.
And it's just, you know, the guys like me who had first had knowledge of it are going away. So
yeah.
I think Roswell is probably on its last legs as far as that goes.
Yeah, but there have been other crashes like the Aztec crash. Scott Ramsey is coming out with a book now about the Aztec crash. I had him on the show several years ago, and he was working on the book. I guess the book has been in progress for 25 years.
Work in progress.
Yeah. And so he wants that book to be out before I have him on the show. Are you familiar with that Aztec crash?
Yeah, I've heard about it. Yeah. I guess I haven't read that much about it.
Yeah. So many crashes of these craft, and they suspect that our radar interferes with their navigational system. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I guess it's possible, but, you know, if they can travel, you know, light years in space, in interstellar space, I think they run into all kind of radio, electromagnetic interferences out there, too, probably more than they would see here.
Yeah.
So I just don't think that's a real strong possibility that they crashed because of our radar.
Do you think in the case of Roswell, or let's talk more about Roswell. There are, like I said, there have been other crashes, but in a case of Roswell, do you think we brought them down? Not with radar, but with weapons?
Well, you know, I would have absolutely no idea about that. I guess anything is possible, but we'd have to be looking for them and be scared of them. But, yeah, I have no idea. But, I guess anything is possible, but I would put that down on the very unlikely list.
Very unlikely, yeah. Yeah, it was stormy weather. Who was it that saw the thing blow up or claimed that they saw it crashing or saw the crash?
Yeah. But again, I think,
it was a bad storm.
This might have been a probe that was just designed to be lost. In other words, just like we're sending probes out to other planets, this could be just one of their probes, and they didn't care whether it crashed or not. And as a matter of fact, any bodies that might have been on it might have been clones, and they were disposable.
Hmm. Now, there's a thought. I was going to say they had some of their beings on board. How could they do that? But who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? At any rate, we're... Jesse Marcel, Jr., where can we find out more about your book, The Roswell Legacy?
Well, they can... I think it is being handled by one of the presses. It's on Kindle, and they can go to some of the bookstores, order through the bookstores. I used to have some here that I sent out, but I've kind of gotten out of that. But it's on Kindle, and some of the major book publishers have it that way.
Right. Okay. So, do you have a website? Your own website?
I gave it up. I'm kind of withdrawing. As a matter of fact, I'm getting old and had enough of it.
Enough of it. But anyway, well, I will say The Roswell Legacy by Jesse Marcel Jr. And Jesse, I certainly appreciate you being our guest today.
Well, it's my pleasure. I enjoy talking about it. And it's an ongoing adventure.
Yes, it is. So thank you once again for joining us.
You betcha. And talk to you later, buddy.
Okay, bye-bye. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. Stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. And please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mystery.